This week on Writers, Inc.
The burden's really on you to keep the reader for those first parts until you have the enough opportunity to hook them with the story.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm J.P. Reinflush.
I'm J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. I am still in what my daughter refers to as the fat suit. I tweak my back. It's been like 10 days and like I'm wearing this brace underneath my clothes. But it makes it look like I weigh like 100 pounds more than I do. It's crazy, crazy uncomfortable. And I have to wear sweatpants. Like I can't put jeans on with it because where the bottom of the brace is.
Okay, so you're basically the guys from Saturday Night Live. You're like, we will pump you up.
That's what it kind of looks like. I'm going for that, but like you can tell that it's padding, you know, you can tell that it's not legit. And like right now I'm wearing a dress shirt and sweatpants. So like I am a complete mess. Like
you could just get a Santa suit. It would be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. That might work.
Christmas in March.
Why not?
Yeah. I'm regretting the temperature change though, because it's getting warmer and like all the padding on this stupid brace is like super hot. And you know, like warmer, it's like I think 42 degrees or something outside. It's not crazy warm, but like that, like we were debating putting the air conditioning on yesterday because like that's a big shift for us from the subarctic temperatures we had. And Kevin, you're in Pennsylvania now, right?
Yeah,
like you're a little north of so that's got to be a shock for you too, right? I mean, it's nothing like Texas.
It's funny because we got here and like for the first 3 days we were here, there was snow every day. And then suddenly it was just gone. And today it's been back in the below 30 here. So I'm in the van right now and it's a little chilly because every time I kick the heater on, it runs the battery down.
So are you guys liking the colder temperatures or are you just wishing for 100 degrees again?
No, I like it. I've always hated it being hot. I can't.
Yeah.
Because I can always put more clothes on to warm up, but I tend to be arrested when I take clothes off. So
fair point.
This is true. Although in Pennsylvania, they're not quite as strict about it. There's a lot of people there that do very odd things.
Yeah.
Have you found a place to write yet?
So this van has turned into kind of a nice portable office when I need it. So the writing isn't so bad. I've been hitting a lot of coffee shops. I've found half a dozen coffee shops here locally that are actually really good. And I, you know, I plug the AirPods in, so, you know, I have things going, so I don't get distracted by the noises, but it's been an adjustment because, you know, not having the dedicated office space means I'm constantly shifting and moving around. So that's been a little exhausting. I'll be honest, but I'm starting to get used to it again.
Yeah, there's something about those creature comforts. Like I've got literally the setup that you were saying nobody's got. Like I've got the dedicated office space. There's a fireplace going behind me.
Yeah,
you know, I've got a beautiful view. I grab my coffee out of the kitchen, plant myself in my very, you know, comfy, expensive chair when I'm home. But like we just spent two nights in Boston and, you know, we were in a hotel room and, you know, like I'm there with my wife and daughter. So like I set up on the little desk like I usually do. But, you know, when there's other people in the room, that's a whole other dynamic. I've got my daughter watching Bluey and whatever is on Disney, you know, bouncing on the bed, playing on her iPad right behind me. You know, like noise canceling headphones can only stop so much. Words still need to be made, though.
Yeah. Did you wash your underwear in the coffee maker? That's the question.
I did not. No. And like I was sitting there, like it was on the desk with me, the hotel coffee maker.
Just staring at it.
I was just staring at it. And I was like totally creeped out, not only because of that TikTok, but like just thinking about all the times, you know, where I have made coffee in the coffee maker at the hotel. Hey, you guys drank some of it, you know, when we were at Author Nation.
I had a coffee maker. Sure, believe me, that's the first thing I thought of. Yeah,
you know,
I think sanitized, somebody, right? It's been boiled. It's fine.
I think Mr. Coffee has an opportunity. They need to make an underwear cleaner along with the coffee maker. Maybe two compartments or something on the same device.
Oh God, no!
Mr. Undy.
Maybe not the same device, but sure.
What they need to is to make it in a way that you can't get underwear in the coffee maker. Like, you know, like
she was talking about the
garbage cans for bears. We need underwear free coffee.
She even called out the coffee pod machines, though. Like she was somehow cleaning her underwear in those things. So that's crazy.
Well, I mean, luckily there is a trend lately of Starbucks opening in hotels. Like they are like aggressively moving into every hotel lobby, which that's I am smart. All for. I have no problem now paying $6 for a cup of coffee, you know, taking the elevator down and getting that.
I'm if I can get
the underwear cleaning machine.
Not me. I've got a portable coffee setup. Yes. Yeah. And I sent you guys some links, but I have this thing called a cauldron, which is like a travel mug that will boil the water for me. It even has attachments. Like there's one attachment that has a coffee grinder and it's got a little thing where I can set it down and it'll keep the coffee hot. So, you know, I've been carrying that, but I'm thinking about just getting, they make collapsible like silicone kettles.
Yeah.
For like $25. So I was thinking about getting one of those and a French press.
You have clearly never had your bag searched by a guy with a machine gun in Turkey before.
Believe me, I have. That's why I don't carry the grinder with me because it's basically a bunch of whirling blades, but the, you know, the little mug and everything, that generally gets through.
I get very squeamish. I mean, TSA always freaked me out. I've only been stopped like one time, and I think it was because I had 25 books in a carry-on, and they couldn't tell what it was when they scanned it. But I'm always cognizant of what I've got in the bag and what it's going to look like on the little x-ray machine. But when I was in Turkey, that literally happened. Like, they've got soldiers just walking around the airport, and they will just pick somebody at random, and they will open your suitcases right there on the chair next to you or wherever. And, you know, they barely speak English. They're holding a machine gun. You're not going to say no. So I don't want anything in there that I've got to explain in a little room in the back somewhere, you know, if it's going to delay my flight. Coffee maker sounds like a fantastic idea, but it just sounds like something that would be difficult to explain under the wrong circumstances.
Yeah. I think I'll be taking one to Vegas this year, though, because we never have coffee makers in our room.
The hotel right next to our Author Nation hotel, I was in the Paris, there was a CVS right there, and they had coffee pods and they had coffee makers, like all just stacked right by the door, because none of the rooms actually had them. I guess that's not something they normally put in the hotel rooms there, which is, I guess a good thing now. Now I understand why. Anyway, what is in the news?
In the news, Amazon categories ain't what they used to be. Amazon has been recently moving books out of categories authors selected. And the rise of, quote, ghost categories is accelerating. Amazon is dynamically testing books in additional category paths based on performance signals. Sometimes this helps. Sometimes it removes you from categories you thought were locked in. The real question, whether this is a temporary shift or a preview of how Amazon plans to handle categorization going forward.
You know, this in a lot of ways makes a lot of sense, right? Because the categories seem very outdated as far as a process. You know, they've got our entire book there. They've got the browsing history. They can see who's looking at it. They can see who's reading the free, you know, preview. They can see how far they got into the free preview. Like, there's so many different metrics they can use now in real time to figure out who to put the book in front of. I like the fact that they might have categories that are dynamic and are going to change on the fly, because Amazon's ultimate plan, or, you know, their desire is to sell whatever that product is.
Right.
You know, so if they can tweak it and get it in front of more people, I think that's a win for us.
Yeah, I want them to
categories
do...
just sucks, right? Like, nobody knows how to properly pick categories.
Well, they never have the right categories. Like, most of my books are archaeological thrillers. The closest thing to that is historical fiction. And that's it. And so that doesn't narrow things down. Right. So I hit number one in historical fiction, like, over and over again. But, you know, I'm not like a Ken Follett or somebody like that, you know. So I risk disappointing readers who discover the book that way. So
And I mean, like, Amazon has not only the seller information and the buyer personalities, but they also have all of your manuscript. So, like, they have both ends of the spectrum, and you'd think that they would likely start researching ways to ensure that your book is placed in the right spot. And so it almost makes more sense, in though I can disagree somewhat. I see Jenna shaking her head, but at the same time, they have all of that info.
A lot of us think we know what our book is about, and we may not necessarily be right.
Yeah.
You know, I've been playing with AI using it just for that purpose. It's just dropping a book in there and like, does this blurb actually, you know, accurately reflect what I'm, you know, what the book itself is about? And you know, I'm finding that sometimes it doesn't. You know, you've got to make some tweaks. You know, you think the story is about something and it turns out it's about something else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think mostly is if you haven't looked at your categories recently, you might want to just to see what categories you're in. But this was from an email from Kindlepreneur, and there is a free article up that goes into the changes, like if you want to understand it in more detail and maybe how you can leverage it right now, that might be something you want to take a look at.
Well, hint, you have no control over it. They're going to do what they want to do.
Yeah, but you
lay
have a
back
short
and
window.
Enjoy.
You have a short window maybe to take some advantages of whatever they're doing right now. So it's worth looking at. Yeah.
Next up, death. The death of Spotify. Why streaming is minutes away from being obsolete. Music executive Jimmy Iovine argues that streaming platforms like Spotify could become obsolete because they function as interchangeable utilities offering the same massive catalogs with little differentiation or strong profit margins. The shift to streaming means record labels no longer control distribution or listener data, leaving artists dependent on tech platforms that limit direct relationships with fans. The current pro rata payout model favors megastars, funneling most subscription revenue toward the most streamed artists while making it difficult for mid-level musicians to earn sustainable income. The article suggests the future of music may lie in direct-to-fan, quote, micro-communities, where artists focus on ownership, fan engagement, merch, and live experiences rather than relying on streaming revenue alone. This sounds very similar to what's happening.
Sounds a little bit like the book industry, doesn't it?
Yeah. But it also sounds a lot like what the model used to be before streaming, because radio stations kind of had this same grip over the music industry. The mid-level artist didn't get to make much of a dent.
Yeah, no, it was the same fight. I used to work for RCA and BMG, and like, you know, you would call it, let's say, a top 40 radio station. They would literally have, you know, like the set of 25 songs that they would play over and over again. You know, you hear them every 3 or 4 hours, and you would have to try and squeeze your one song in there. And you know, we bribed people. You know, like it would come down to that. You know, like you get them lunch, you send them tickets to the next Knicks game, whatever you had to do to get that song played. And now there's nobody to bribe, you know, so I don't know how you go about doing it.
Yeah. I've been using a streaming platform called Qobuz, Qobuz, and it's just like Spotify where it has that streaming capability, but then you can buy the music outright right on the platform. And not only that, but it pays the, indie or just the musicians better. But I almost feel like that's kind of the direction because it's so hard to be discoverable. We kind of know this when we're trying to do direct sales ourselves, where having kind of that platform where it almost gives that direct opportunity among the streaming, I think is like that good transition period.
But you're buying the music, but what happens if that platform goes under? Do you lose the music?
I think you get the MP3 of it.
Okay. So you stole something.
Yeah, I think you get it.
To iTunes?
Okay,
I miss CDs. I miss having the physical thing.
You laugh, but I always get this. I still buy individual songs to put in my playlist in iTunes and put them in music. And every time it's like, do our 3 month Apple Music. I'm like, no, I just want this one song on my playlist.
Right,
and
now
I pay my 99 cents.
There's a big move towards kids are asking for classic iPods and buying them off
that.
Like eBay and
really?
Stuff. Yeah.
Interesting.
There's a big movement to that because they're saying one theory about it is that with schools across the U.S. now banning mobile phones from being on campus at all, that this is a way for them to have their music, you know, even without having the phone. So that's one thing that's kind of driving it. So
yeah. My husband's iPod is just giving up the ghost, and he's been trying to put it on his phone, but he's just an audiophile, so the collection is so extensive in terms of memory he just can't switch it to another device, so he'll be happy if they bring them back. If
I'm a subscriber to his Substack, by the way.
Oh cool.
You want to plug it real quick?
If you like Americana, blues, jazz, folking around.
Folking yeah. around, that's what it
folking
is.
Around. He talks a lot about music. So
mm-hmm. It's good. Right. He's good.
Cool.
I don't comment. I should comment. All right. This is the final story. Former Amazon executive Greg Greeley named CEO of Simon & Schuster. Greg Greeley, a longtime former Amazon executive, has been named CEO of Simon & Schuster, marking one of the few times a major trade publisher has hired a top leader from outside traditional publishing. Greeley previously helped develop Amazon's early books ecosystem, including print-on-demand and self-publishing initiatives, and later held senior roles at Airbnb and other tech-driven companies. He says his initial focus will be to, quote, listen and learn while addressing publishing's biggest challenge, competition for audience attention from social media, streaming, and other media formats.
But as a Simon & Schuster author, I am very happy about this. There is nothing that Simon & Schuster has done since I started working with them that I don't like. Like, they always seem to be very forward-thinking. You know, the people they bring in are very forward-thinking. And this guy, like, he sent an email out when he first came aboard, you know, even to people like me, you know, asking for opinions. You know, like, what do you like? What do you not like? You know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I've been kind of impressed. Every time I turn around, Simon & Schuster's doing something a little more forward-thinking. And I keep waiting for the rest of the big publishing houses to kind of follow suit, but they almost seem to be just sprinting the other direction, like throwing away their technological devices and diving into caves.
It feels a lot like they're just putting their blinders on and trying to pretend nothing else is happening.
Yeah,
yeah. The world isn't changing. Nothing is changing around us. Don't you know? Nothing to see here.
You know what it reminds me of? When I was working, I briefly wrote for the Houston Chronicle, and the ownership there, when the internet kind of started to grow in popularity, they were adamant that it was just a fad and it was going to fade and go away. So they invested nothing in it. And then a couple of years later, like blogging took over and, you know, the whole industry shifted, but they held on for like a decade. There was, you know, it was like, 2005, and they're like, no, this internet thing, it's going away any minute now, you know.
Yeah,
so. Good for
people
them.
Don't like change, you know. It's a joke kind of like in the sci-fi community that they write the most about change but hate it the most. So
yeah,
people don't like change.
No
You know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year, one that's almost done but never quite gets there? Well, right now, it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis, marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane. And right now you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book. Start making real progress, escape revision limbo, and publish with confidence story after story. Check out AutoCrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's AutoCrit.com/JD.
Okay, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got J.R. Thornton coming on. J.R. graduated from Harvard and later earned an M.A. at university in Beijing. He currently lives in Italy and works for A.C. Milan. His second novel called Lucian is coming out through Harper on March 17th. Here he is, J.R. Thornton.
All right, J.R. Thornton. So you moved between a ton of places, from London, New Jersey, Beijing, Harvard, now Italy, probably a few places as well that I haven't mentioned. But how do you think that those multicultural shifts shaped the way that you understand people and how it might have impacted the way that you wrote books like Lucian?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. For me, writing fiction is always, it's an exercise in empathy. It's about putting yourself in other people's shoes. And And I think when you're constantly moving, especially when you're a young kid, you're constantly having to figure out how do I fit in here? You're making new friends always, changing schools, whatnot. And so I think you get good at becoming at figuring out how to adapt and how to read new situations and fit in places. So I think that and you're also just exposed to lots of different perspectives and different types of people, which I think is useful for thinking about characters and whatnot. So for me, it had a big impact. And my first book was about time I spent in China. So you can see it there as well.
Yeah, and I think you can definitely see that in like Atlas's character, how, being sort of this new person in this new world and having to experience it through those eyes. So I think, yeah, you can definitely see that impact. But you mentioned Beautiful Country, which was your first novel, which grew out of your teenage years playing tennis in China. And now you have Lucien, which is totally different tone, totally different genre. What drew you to this like darker psychological twist?
Yeah, so I think that it's funny because with Beautiful Country, it was really like a book that I started writing before I really knew how to write a novel. And so it really grew out of like, the very, very first version was probably almost a travelogue and had no story arc to it and whatnot. And then so I once I had sort of taken enough like writing courses at university that I knew how to structure stories properly. I then went back to that and shaped it into a story, but I don't know that I've ever really thought of it as like if I was starting from scratch, this is the type of book that I'd write from the beginning. And so with Lucien, it's more of a it's a bit more of a commercial plot. It's got more thriller elements. It's got a stronger plot. And I wanted to write a book that would kind of grab you from the beginning and be fun to read and have characters and tension and drama and try to like have the put the attention of the detail to the level of the prose, but then take like the best elements of thrillers and stuff. So that's sort of how I
Yeah.
thought.
Yeah. And it sounds like sort of exploring your writer craft, you figured you wanted to move towards this more genre thriller-esque tone, which happens a ton of times. That's awesome.
I mean, I think it's like just the thrillers have a lot of built-in advantages in terms of engaging people with the plot right away. And then I think when you're starting out, that can be helpful as well.
Yeah, and I'd heard in an interview that you had a couple years ago, something that you said was really interesting. Books live or die on the first page. So, in terms of that, what was the hardest thing about getting the right opening for Lucien, trying to get more of that marketable hit towards it?
I think that this is something that I learned from Brett Johnston, who I studied under at Harvard, who he told us this about short stories as well. He's like, if your first sentence isn't good, no one's going to read past that, and if the second, the first paragraph's not good, and so it's you, the burden's really on you to keep the reader for those first parts until you have the enough opportunity to hook them with the story. So the opening was something I thought a lot about. I ended up not using like this opening line, but I had an opening line almost from the beginning and before I had a title, before I had anything like that. And so that yeah, but it was something I sort of put a lot of thought into.
Yeah. And in terms of like story structure, you also have this character who sort of starts to unravel, and you still need to keep him a bit charismatic, and while letting those cracks show. So, in terms of that, like what methods or approaches do you take to ensure that those characters aren't portrayed as reprehensible to the reader, but still have those sort of cracks show?
Yeah, it was like, I mean, great question. It was one of the hardest parts of this novel was figuring out where to draw the line with Lucien and where for him to be how sociopathic versus redeemable and in the middle it gets a bit tricky because if someone's displaying a bit of both, you're like, is that an accurate portrayal of someone in real life? But I wanted him to be more of a complex character than someone that was just sort of a straight sociopath, no empathy, that's not redeemable, because I think that is inherently like a more complex, more interesting character.
Yeah.
But it was tricky. And even throughout the rewriting process, I was getting constantly one person telling me, you have to make Lucien darker, blah, blah, blah. And then, but also same time knowing that if I go too far that way, he'll become unlikable. And then the reader's not going to be engaged in the story. So it's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, Lucien being related to Saltburn, that's definitely like that path of sort of villainry in one sense or another is a really tough thing to hit. But when it does hit, it is very delectable to watch and read. And so, yeah, we have this character unraveling from beginning to end. And then we also have this revelation that happens at the ending and having to put all that like fun foreshadowing in the beginning and sort of moving backwards. So in terms of that like colliding effect, what was sort of like your favorite foreshadowing trick or moment that you did to sort of point towards the end?
I think for me, the one is there's a scene pretty early on where there's a suicide at the school and a guy kills himself in the middle of the yard, which is something that actually happened when I was at school. And this event has sort of a outsized impact on Lucien, and he kind of goes into a bit of a sort of a depressive like spiral for a few days over it. And you're not really sure why, because it seems very out of character.
Yeah.
And he, during that period, he kind of tells a story about a kid he knew in high school, and you don't really realize the relevance of that till the end. So I like that one because I felt it was, I liked that idea of you get to the end of the book and you learn stuff about the character, and then it reframes how you got all this information that you maybe brushed over initially.
Yeah, that's, I love that tool. I love that a poet thrillers. I don't write them myself, but I love finding those pieces and sort of moving backwards. So it's a really fun trick to have. And your character over time becomes, Atlas becomes this art forger, because that's sort of how he can live into this elite world. And you interviewed real art forgers who served prison time to write this book. I'm just curious, like doing this sort of extra research and this thing that is related to the novel, what was some of the more like surprising things you learned from those conversations that you wouldn't have expected otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of my favorite parts of writing the book, was just learning about this whole world that I knew nothing about. And there's so many interesting stories that we don't have time for, but just a few things I can think of. One is that the estimate is that 30% of the market, 30% of the art on the market is fake.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of these forgers out there that had paintings in the Louvre and the Tate and the Met, all these, you know, massive museums. And a lot of them are still in there apparently, cause they said that, you know, I didn't tell them all the ones that were fake basically. One of the guys I interviewed, Joe Maya, who him and his partner had kind of a genius scheme where they would basically insert documents into the archives of museums to then create provenance for the fakes that they were making. So you'd go check the museum archives and you'd find a record of a sale from 1930 an exhibition that this painting was shown in. And they realized that no one is checking if you're putting stuff in archives, only if you take stuff out. But he was painting with just regular house paint, like not even using oil paint, and his paintings were in the Tate. So that was pretty staggering to me. But I mean, there's a million of these stories, but it's been a while.
Yeah. I think I had heard you say something like, a painting can be worth millions one day, and then, you know, the next second it's zero, just because it's a forgery. And that's just that. And in and of itself, that there are paintings still today that are probably forgeries, is nuts. That's wild.
The thing is, like, there's no real incentive for anybody to sort of identify that it's a forgery. Yeah. Because everybody's making money as long as it continues to be a real painting. The middleman, the auctioneers, the person selling it, the person buying it, nobody wants to find out they bought a fake Picasso, right? So and if you do say it's like, if you're Sotheby's and you say it's a fake, you can then get sued by the person trying to sell it, who says, no, you're wrong, and you cost me $20 million, so here's a lawsuit. So it's sort of a weird incentive structure.
I love being able, as a writer, to do those sorts of research things and go on those sorts of adventures. That's really cool that you were able to do that. So looking back on your life and the high pressure environments that you've been in, you've been to Harvard, you've been to China doing tennis, all over the place. And with Lucien, one of the threads is the cost of ambition, especially when ambition that you're not sure is like your own. What do you think in your life shaped that mindset or that thought to help you drive the story in Lucien?
I think that maybe it's a question of sort of maybe ambition at all costs, or ambition if you're trying to take a shortcut to get there, maybe. There was a real life student that who was maybe 4 or 5 years above me at Harvard, who is one of the places where I got the sort of initial idea for the story. But he got all the way to being a finalist for the Rhodes Scholarship, was months away from graduating. Supposedly, you know, on paper had a 4.0 from Harvard, would have, you know, had so many opportunities afterwards if he just had stopped there, but kept pushing, went for the Rhodes, and someone on the committee realized his essay was plagiarized. And then they looked into everything and realized it was all fake. And he had never gone to these schools he said he went to. SAT scores were made up. And so that, I always thought that was fascinating, that like this is a little bit Icarus flying too close to the sun, you know, and just like, if he just stopped a little bit sooner, he would have been. So, yeah. So that sort of, in the context of this book, sort of where that idea came from.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting. Okay, so I do have a question, because we have Lucien was first published in China in 2024, and now it's coming to the U.S. Did anything change between the editions as you prepared it for this audience over here?
Maybe minor changes. Basically, the story there is that, my first novel, Beautiful Country, was set in China, and was published there. By a publisher, Guomai, and I contacted them when I finished my second one, and they were, you know, sort of gung-ho to publish it, and so and the US was much tougher, so I moved ahead with that, and I was like, I'll get a sales track record at least, and then can, you know, try again in the US basically. So I made some modifications also, like based on the feedback of the editor, HarperCollins, after signing the deal and stuff, but the story is relatively the same, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah. I found it fascinating because, like, as you know, an author, you try to figure out how you can get into the market, and being able to have it in the Chinese market and then use that as a leverage to sort of expand it on is something that I'm sure a lot of people are looking to do. And I guess to add to that as well, when you're sort of returning to a book that you have a lot of distance with, at least 2 years, probably more, and then you're out promoting it again for an entirely different market, does the story hit differently for you now that you're sort of promoting it to a different audience?
I would say, I mean, what's always interesting is that, and I saw this with my first book as well, was just maybe certain things resonate a little bit more in one place versus another. And just, yeah, I guess seeing what maybe resonates with the culture at that time in one place versus in another is always a little bit different. Obviously, the core things are always the same, but sometimes people have different takes on certain characters or something like that.
Yeah. Is there something about Lucien that you have yet to be asked, or something like a craft thing that you used in Lucien that you're really excited about that maybe you haven't been able to talk about yet?
It's a good question. From a craft perspective, this is something I'd never done before, but we talked earlier about the opening to the book. You know, I sort of got to a point where I was like, I don't know if I can make this much better. Like, I've taken as far as I can. But there are still like maybe some, you know, points where it could have been stronger. And so I looked at the opening and the ending of every chapter, and I went to 5-7 books that I really liked, and literally photocopied the first page and the last page of every chapter in those books and put them up on the wall, and was like looking at them every day, and then like highlighting ones I liked, and then figuring out, because I think that's important too for keeping the reader going as well, and also setting the tone of the chapter and whatnot. So that was something I never thought about doing before, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think a lot of writers run into that, but when you're able to look at especially the things that you enjoy in your genre and emulate, maybe slight, not really mimic in the same sense, but you know what I mean? Be able to see how the structure exists to remove barriers that you know, certain people may have to reading that. I think that that's a really good method or good project or idea to use. Anything coming up in your world in the next book that's coming out or the next project that you're working on?
Honestly, at the moment, I don't have too much on. I'm working for AC Milan in Italy, doing something a bit different. I had been basically writing since I left university, and I got to the end of Lucien, and I wasn't sure if the book would get published, and B, I didn't have any ideas I was really sort of excited about, and books take a long time to write, and I was like, if I'm not excited about an idea right now, if I force it, and then in 6 months I'm going to hate it, and then it's going to be bad, and so. I think I was ready for a new adventure and to try something different and have a new experience. And, but that's has given me the chance then to think about a lot of ideas. And now I'm like, I would love to get back to writing. And, I have some ideas for a sequel to Lucien as well, where you see what happens to the character after the book. But yeah, it's still sort of idea stage at this point.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, as a final question, what writing advice were you given or do you wish you had been given when you were just starting your writing career?
I got a lot of good advice from, especially from Brett, who I studied under. One of the things he told me, which has been super valuable, is he's like, the easiest way to take your writing from, you know, medium to good is by doing research and by making sure that every element of your story is grounded in reality to some extent, or is at least consistent with the rules that you've set up for that world. And that's down to the vocab that certain characters use, you know, on the basis of what jobs they do or something. You know, like a police officer might use the word vehicle, we might use the word car.
Yeah.
And he's like, if you don't want it to read like a research piece. Like, you don't want to say, here's everything I learned about fishing or whatever, but if those details are accurate, then it'll feel like a real world to the reader. And if they're not accurate, it'll remind them that it's a made up story and you'll lose the reader. So that was something that like was super valuable for me. And then I think like it's something that maybe people don't talk about so much, but for me, one of the hardest parts is just, you know, it's a solitary existence and it requires a lot of self-discipline and resilience and stuff, because it's a long process. You don't get rewards, you know, right away and stuff. And so I think that's just being able to develop like a good sense of good routine, good self-discipline, good like staying mentally in the middle, not too high, not too low, I think is super key.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Jared Thornton, thank you so much for coming on and congrats on your release of Lucien. I hope it goes well and have a lovely rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
All right, so JR said that books live or die on the first page. Do you approach your first page differently from the rest of your novels?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The first sentence, I think it has to be a grabber. You know, it's got to pull people in and it's got to hold them. I mean, I write thrillers, so I think it's even more so in that particular genre. But yeah, attention spans are just so short these days. Like you need something that's going to just grip that reader and not let them go.
Yeah, that's why I start every book with "Read this book, or you're going to die."
There you go.
Perfect. That would probably work.
Yeah. Once. Is that how you approach it, the first line and first page, or is it like a range of like the first three pages that you're really like fine tuning and molding that differently than you approach the rest of your novel?
Man, I've got page one demand. It has to grab you on page one or it's dead. That's my theory.
Yeah, I do think it. You have to start with like sentence one, page one, chapter one, and then like try to maintain that exact sort of like, you know, tension and you know, that gripping nature of it throughout the whole thing, because it does set, it's sort of like setting the tone, you know, like you kind of I heard someone describe like, you know, if you met a book at a cocktail party, right? So it's like that first sentence is sort of like your introduction, and, you know, the first page is kind of, you know, and you kind of need to grab someone, right? Like you don't want to have like a bad introduction and then they go like, oh, my buddy's over here.
Yeah.
A lot of people tend to throw the, you know, the gold a little later, like especially new writers, they don't like, they figure, oh, you know, this happens on chapter three or whatever, so I'm good. But like people never get to chapter three anymore.
Right.
Like it has to be at the very beginning.
Yeah.
I'm scarred working with Patterson because I can literally hear him on the phone with me, you know, snoring. You need to liven this up. It's putting me to sleep. You know, that kind of thing. So like when you hear that kind of, when you hear it enough, it drives you.
Yeah.
But I think it holds true no matter what genre you're writing. I think it you know, you got to get that.
Yeah. I agree. Okay. So we've got first page down pat. How about dark characters and making them likable without pushing them too far into the unlikable range? How do you approach that?
It's so hard.
It is really hard. Well, what's that quote where they say, like, you know, the villain is the hero of their own story? I do think that that sort of is like at the heart of creating a good dark character. Like, you have to like let the reader see things from their perspective. I think that's one thing that, you know, made that the series You by Carolyn Kepney so good, right? Is that, you know, Joe's not a good guy, but like he kind of, you understand him, and that helps, I think, in kind of continuing to share that headspace with the character.
Well, he
like
thinks
that.
He's a good guy, right? And because you're in his head, you understand why he thinks he's a good guy.
Yeah, and some of his points, you're like, he low-key makes a little sense.
Thanos was right. That's all I'm saying. No,
I think that's what makes a good dark character, is that like as the reader, you start to be like,
yeah,
I get it.
Yeah. JR said that he stepped away from writing for a while and even worked in another field when he didn't have an idea he loved. So what do you do when you hit the slump part of your job, and how do you go through it?
Wait, can we just say that he just casually threw in that he works for AC Milan? I was like, what? I really didn't even ask about that. Jay's like, sports. No, we're good.
Who is that?
It's a football team in Italy.
Oh, you know, okay.
Big one, right?
Soccer.
Yeah.
Not American football.
For you Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, could you guys actually do that, though? Because, like, I don't think I could physically not write. You know, if I go a day or two without writing something, I get all twitchy. Like, that's
I'm
my
cranky.
Outlet. So, like,
I get cranky.
Yeah, I mean, I could work another job or whatever, but I would have to write somehow in between.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop.
My marriage depends on me writing. If I'm not writing, the marriage may be over.
Yeah. I think like for me, like I definitely couldn't stop writing, but I could see a future where like working in a lab might be something that I would enjoy doing on and off. Mm-hmm. If there was ever the opportunity to do so, because I always enjoyed doing that and doing some research stuff. But even then, I would want to be writing.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I've had like times where it's been hard to write, but it's not like that urge goes away or sort of like the thinking about it goes away. So I don't know. I think when I get stuck, I tend to try to figure out why I'm stuck.
Yeah.
You know, like if there's no good ideas, like kind of thinking about why there's not good ideas, kind of exploring that a little bit. Or I'll go into like binge reading or binge watching different things, or I'll just kind of like, I find that I will start going towards other creative things to try. And then like things start going again at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do the same thing. I'm in the mushy middle of something right now and it wasn't working out the way I wanted to. And I'm like, I'm just going to put this down. And really what happens is I'm just cranky for like a couple days and then binge read and get back to it. So
I got severely burnt out, and I started writing one of my Kotler books back in 2024, and just put it aside because I kind of got stuck. And over the past week or so, I picked it back up again, and I'm like, I've reinvented the book, and it's just now I'm really excited about it. So I don't think there's anything wrong with kind of putting a book on pause as long as you are committed to coming back to it.
Yeah.
I have this whole thing where I think we have like a moral and ethical obligation to tell the stories that we think are going to be, you know, touching and moving and, you know, exciting. I think we're obligated to create stories.
That's interesting. I look at it like, you know, that phrase, if you love it, let it go. Like, I've been willing to walk away from books, and sometimes like I'll think of them and think like, oh yeah, no, that was definitely the right call. And then I'll have other ones that I'm like, oh, now I know what to do with it. It's sort of like, you know, once you let it go, it's either going to come back or it's not. But
yeah, I'm from Texas. If you love it, let it go. If it doesn't come back, you hunt it down and you beat it until it agrees to come back.
Wow.
No.
All right, Kevin.
Noted.
But I do think, you know, sometimes putting a piece aside until you figure it out is okay. But yeah, like then I work on something else. It's not like not writing.
Exactly.
You know,
so, yeah.
Yeah.
There's never a point where I'm not writing. That's for sure.
I owe a couple people short stories right now. So I think it was Stephen King who said he writes short stories on Monday or something. But I started doing that on Saturday. So Saturdays is no longer working on the same book I've been working on all week. I'm working on the short stories. And I'm finding that through the week, I end up, you know, thinking about them and I, you know, come up with new ideas for them. So I'm excited about it. And it's fun to sit down on Saturday and implement all that. And also it's, you know, it's a little nice to take a little break from the, whatever the work in progress is, you know, even if it's only for the day. The same thing happens. Yeah, I'm working on that short story and I'm thinking about stuff for the book. And it, you know, feels just a little bit more fun when I step back into it, which I like.
Yeah, I think that's healthy.
I think that feeds the creativity back and forth between the two, right? And I like that.
Yeah.
And you're saying that you to work on things.
I have a hard time because I feel guilty because I know I've got that other book to get back to. So I love writing short fiction and I'm trying to do a lot more of it. And I had said, when I heard that about Stephen King, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make Mondays, you know, short story day or something. I've tried several times now, but I feel so guilty that I'm not working on the book that I end up scrapping it and going back to the book. So that's my psychological issue.
Something to unpack there, Kevin.
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Karen Robards coming on. Karen's the New York Times bestselling author of more than 50 novels. She also won the Silver Pen Award 6 times. Her latest is about a young woman in the Irish Rebellion called The Moonlight Runner and releases on March 24th. Karen Robards.
Yeah, it was such a fun conversation. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.